The Articles of NATO clearly lay down that we would use everything in our power to contain wars. Here was an example where the United Nations had
jumped together, understanding. No, I'm not asking for the rationale. I'm thinking of what your impressions. I'm not saying. I think we all know why we got into Korea and what the results were and all those types of things, but I'm thinking of the military aspect, the naval aspect. Did the Canadian Navy do a good job there? Was the job worth doing, I guess is what I'm asking.
I'm going to answer in the affirmative to they did a good job there. They adjust themselves to the conditions very well. They weren't easy. It made the building of a good Navy in Canada very difficult, because I said so many of my key officers were out here, so many of my key personnel were out here, and we were trying to settle down after the Second World War into an efficient organization and efficient service, and this superimposed quite a strain on us, a terrific strain. There were a lot of problems connected with it, and working with the British services, the Americans and the Canadians out there, there are a number of difficulties. They're all in my report. It brought out the need to me to have integration, though.
Integration.
Yes. No such thing as unification. I point out to you. Integration, the need to bring our services under one control. I've always believed in that. Mm-hmm. Integration is at the top. You don't start at the bottom. I pointed out to you, you don't start at cooks, you start at admirals and generals.
Now, you stay with Korea and that, and as head of naval personnel until how long?
I came out to, I stayed there until 1953, the winter of 53. I took over Flag Officer Pacific Coast.
So you would be promoted to Rear Admiral?
Yes.
And you would...
Well, I promoted to Rear Admiral when I was in the job up there.
Oh, you were promoted to Rear Admiral in...
Yeah. And when I was Chief of Naval Personnel.
Naval Personnel. And then you're sent out to...
I was made Acting Rear Admiral there.
Acting.
Yeah.
And your acting was dropped when you became Flag Officer Pacific.
Yeah.
Today, Flag Officer Pacific is the deputy for Maritime Command in Halifax. Is that the same then, or what's the breakdown?
Same job.
No, I understand it's the same job, but is the breakdown the same? Or were you independent out here?
Yes, I was independent command. I didn't come under the flag officer on the east coast. No, I had my commitments. I had to train certain ships for NATO, and I had my commitments to deal with. And let's have it off for a little while.
We're back on. That's right. The machine's working. You leave naval personnel. Right.
Yes.
And you come out to the West Coast here, and you're Flag Officer Pacific, you're Rear Admiral, you're living in the Admiral's house.
Yeah.
You're not responsible to the Admiral East Coast. You're responsible only to Ottawa. What did you find here when you got here?
There was a very good I forget the force tab I had. I think the most important thing to discuss when I got here was I looked at my command. First thing I did is go around my command and look at the task I had to perform. I think it went from Alaska to the American border and inland to I don't know how far into the Arctic. I had a tremendous command to cover here. I never got over it all, but I took a destroyer and went to every nook and cranny on the coast, and I looked at my force tabs, and I said, Jim Hibbert, you've got quite a commitment here, and remembering my time in the Ontario on this coast for 2 years and working with the Americans, remembering my experience at the National War College and my contacts there, the first thing I did on my own was get an airplane and go out and call on the Commander-in-Chief, Pacific, who was Admiral Stump. That's the biggest command in the world. He has a navy bigger than the British Navy, an army bigger than the British Army, and an Air Force bigger than the British Air Force. At the time, way bigger now. He went from Pakistan to Alaska to the South Pole. And
fair chunk of water.
And he covered all the problems in Southeast Asia, came under him, all that. He went to Australia. It was a tremendous command he had. I went down there, and I got I told him my position here. Now, I want to make it very clear. There's no political agreement in the Pacific at that time. There was no... We had a NATO in the Atlantic. We hung our hat on that peg was NATO. We had no political agreement in the Pacific, and our defenses here, our defense of the Pacific, was not tied in with anyone. This made no sense to me, and occasionally we're accused in the military of pushing the government a little bit, and I don't mean to be disrespectful here of any government orders, but I took it on myself to go to see CNC Pacific, who felt it's equally strong that there should be some tie-in between Canada, Alaska, and America on this problem of defenses of this coast. He gave me a wonderful, very fine officer, a man who Admiral Bowen he became. He was a senior captain at the time, and I flew back with this gentleman, and he put him on my staff. And together, we worked out a plan. It was a war plan. And we wrote in very fine print, this will be exercised in peace. But we made that a little note at the bottom of it. It was a war plan. This was signed by myself and Admiral Stump as a recommendation. It was his idea. He said, we'll send this to Ottawa and to Washington. Now, Washington won't want to put it in the waste paper basket, say, Ottawa, in case Ottawa phones them. And Ottawa won't probably put it in the waste paper basket in case Washington phones them. So we sent it to both. And about a month after it was sent there, Mr. Claxton, who was then our minister,
Now, this is all initiated by you and...
Yeah, all initiated by...
No directives to get together.
No, no initiated, none whatsoever. This was initiated by myself, because it's very hard, you see, it's very difficult. Naval Board couldn't initiate anything, because government had no policy for... No political agreements in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
So a Naval Board... I'm not being critical of Naval Board on this.
Their hands were tied.
Mine weren't tied. I had a job to do here, and I was going to tell Ottawa how I thought it should be done. And this is my recommendation, my first report.
You're putting yourself on the limb by doing that?
Oh, I don't mind that.
No, but seriously, you shot at enough.
What?
No, but weren't you seriously, the boat?
A thing like that never entered Jimmy Hibbert's mind from the day he joined the service to the day he left. That didn't occur to me. This was my commitment here. I was going to put forward my recommendations, what required in this command. We have a tremendous coast. You ever looked at BC's coast alone?
4,000 miles?
No, 17,000 miles of coast.
Ins and outs
and corners and nooks and standies. 17,000 miles of coast here, you've got terrific area, and you've got Russia just across the pond,
mm-hmm.
Very close distance, And so I came back, and this Admiral Bowen, he was a man who investigated the Pueblo case. Do you remember the
Pueblo,
yeah. He was on my staff, and we came up with a plan, a very short plan. It was a war plan to be exercised in peace. Mr. Claxton came to my house. He was Minister of National Defense. He stayed with me at the time, and he said, "Jim Hibbert, I cannot take this to Cabinet, because what about Canada's sovereignty if I sign that, if the government agrees to this?" And I said, "But I couldn't resist saying, but Mr. Minister, we're doing this of our own free will. If we don't do it, we've got a vacuum here. And then you won't have a voice, our sovereignty. You won't have a voice in our sovereignty. Somebody will have to fill the vacuum. It'll be the Americans. And you've done this. If you sign this, or you get the Prime Minister, the government to sign this, you've done it of your own free will. If you otherwise, there's a void, and somebody's going to have to fill this vacuum, and you're not going to have a voice in it." It was the happiest thing that ever happened. Ottawa didn't change a word of the agreement. Washington changed one paragraph or two. Very short. And then they didn't know what to call it. They called it the Stump-Hibbert Agreement. And it remained the Stump-Hibbert Agreement for about 10 years. You see, there was no NATO, there was no...
NORAD, nothing.
It's called the Stump-Hibbert Agreement.
Yeah.
Even when Nanymore came out here, he had dinner with me the night after he arrived. He said, "I'm going to have a briefing tomorrow on the Stump-Hibbert Agreement." And I said, "What?" He said, "Don't tell me it's called that now." Still, he said, "Yes, it's still called that." It eventually is now tied into an Alaska-Canadian defense plan, these things of this nature, but I don't know what it's called now. But
I guess that would be your biggest accomplishment as Admiral West Coast.
This is the happiest. I would put, as I said, the happiest one I made in Ottawa was the people have been my life, personnel have been my life. I think the officer training plans were my, I look back in Ottawa, and but I come out here, I looked on that as a number one from a strategic concept point of view. The other one I look on here is a very happy one, is a relationship with BC. That's why I'm proud to show you this clock right up that you're looking at now. It was given to me by the people of British Columbia when I retired. I had a wonderful, I think we developed a wonderful relationship between the military.
Public relations job.
No, I hate the word public relations. I call it human relations. It was, the services have always been inclined to be on their own, particularly the Navy, you know. We're always fighting the government and the Navy. We're always fighting somebody. We are a little inclined to remain to ourselves. I don't know whether you've noticed that in your interviews with other officers or anybody's remarked on you. Well, it's not only a sound service, but you go from Halifax and you meet your friends in Halifax. Then you come out here and you meet, it's other service people you associate with. We weren't associated enough with the business world, the community, being an integral part. I felt very important, an integral part of the community. You see, terribly important that a man in the military understands that he's required and wanted, that he's fulfilling a useful commitment to his nation, and the nation feels he's necessary. He has confidence in himself, confidence in his in the causes to which he is working, and that the people have confidence. It's good for the community to know their military men, just as it is for the military to know their. And they come with a mutual respect. We drew up a place called the Armed Services Center here. It was an organization to link between civilians and sailors, as simple as that, and to establish a liaison between the civilian population, the personnel of the armed forces, all three services, And the contiguous territory bring them close together in a bond of good fellowship. That was the object of the thing. And I got tremendous support from all people in all walks of life here. The premier opened our center, the...
Mr. Bennett.
Yes, Mr. Bennett Sr. And we had all the business people in this area got behind it. And a good Liberty Port is where you have some friends. With these thoughts in mind, the Armed Services Center was formed by a group of prominent business professional men in Victoria. I didn't do it. I just asked them to do it for me, which they did willingly.
And the center was formed. I'm thinking, the only thing that I... Why didn't the city give freedom of the city to the Navy here? Do you have any explanation for that? It still hasn't happened. I mean, the Navy's done more for Victoria.
I don't know.
Any idea? It's just,
I don't know.
No one's approached them, maybe? Or
maybe nobody's approached them. The Navy's been here so long.
They take it for granted.
And there are people from all over Canada. I don't think there's any, I think there's a great friendship towards the services here.
There is, too.
Does anybody ask you that question? Is that why you're asking to me?
Yeah, because when they troop the new color, just recently, the Queen Mother gave a new color in Halifax, I believe, and then they had a trooping of the color over here as well. I was talking with the base information officer. He was saying they had to apply for permission to march through town.
Mm-hmm.
Because... as it turned out, everyone thought they had it, but it turned out that they didn't have freedom in the city.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that, you know, there's a step in the right direction, perhaps. You know, it's a ceremonial thing, as we, you know.
Yes.
But still, it's that type of thing, you know.
They've given it to them in Portsmouth and Plymouth and Chatham in England.
Mm-hmm.
I can't answer your question.
Mm-hmm. To sum up your career as Flag Officer Pacific, you chose to retire early, is that correct?
Well, I had health problems.
Mm-hmm.
I had a circulation problem. I had no alternative. I was retired medically unfit. It was something that I'd picked up. They think I picked it up in Korea, actually.
What's that, right?
And it was a circulation problem. And a very complex thing to deal with. Circulation, and I couldn't stand very length of time. I remember giving a speech to the Board of Trade in Vancouver and moving my legs and hands. I said, "My, you were getting over your points. Well, I was getting my circulation up."
So you were out in what, 1956?
Yeah.
You were out in 1956 as Rear Admiral, and I guess you were still young enough, though, to have gone, Vice Admiral back in Ottawa, I guess,
I couldn't. I was unfit, and I couldn't have left the service under nicer, no government, no board could have been kinder to me. I was, Mr. Clacton said, Mr. Minister, I'm not able to get around here the way I should. I'm not visiting the ships as much as I can. I'm not getting out. And he said, "Well, we're happy with you." And he left it to me. "You can stay as long as you like. And I'm happy." So I couldn't have left under happier circumstances. So I was allowed to pick my day to leave the service. And then there was going to be an increase of pay 2 months later. And I'd pick my day. And they said, "Would you like to stay on 2 months longer? You'll get your increase of pay." And I said, "No, I've made my date. And I think one shouldn't dilly-dizzy-dally over this thing." And... Admiral Mingy came out to see me, and I left under the happiest circumstances. Admiral Stump, who signed the Stump-Hibbert Agreement, flew in to say goodbye to me, which I think is the only time in history of Commander-in-Chief Pacific. You've had Commander's Pacific Fleet
mm-hmm.
been here. I think it's the only time in history that a Commander-in-Chief Pacific has come to this command.
During the time, too.
Yeah, so I'll show you a picture of him here. He still is a friend. He died 2 years ago. He died a great friend of mine. He's tremendous, great, great American, great sailor. And
now, who takes over the post from you? Is it
Pullen?
Admiral Pullen.
Yes, Admiral Pullen took over from me.
An old friend, I assume.
Yes, very long.
So you finish your career in 1956. You're still a relatively young man. You've a very distinguished career. You've sure been in the thick of things from the beginning. Any regrets at all?
look back on it, I had a wonderful time. Wonderful time. I couldn't ask for a happier third of a century than and a more interesting one. Mm-hmm. And I was the right age group when the war came on. I was the interesting period when I went between the wars. I told you about the Spanish Civil War and the different periods in my previous interviews with you. I think it was, looking back on it, I'm trying to get my papers together now. I find my wife has kept scrapbooks, and I have drawers full of things downstairs to tie in with, whether be it going to Mexico and to be guest of the Mexican government, and or being going. Looking back files the other day, I should have looked these files up before you started interviewing me. I remember guest of the Venezuelan government, the wonderful experiences being, I would say, the greatest thing in my memory, in the services, being the tremendous help the United States services has given us in Canada. I talked a lot about back and forth with England. When it came to the real test, the real training, the force taps, when I had this command, I could go out here and join with the American forces, which I did, take tactical command at sea of their forces, be they aircraft carriers, cruisers, take tactical command at sea and in exchange back tactical command and joint exercises, which is Stump Hibbert Agreement. We took fleet right out to Australia.
Still do.
Mm-hmm. These were built up from 48 when I was 47, 48 when I had the Ontario. But that to me is probably the happiest memory that I wish I could get someone to write a book on what it's meant to Canada and Canada's armed forces to have the Americans at our to help us in all this period, and the training and the exercises, and in fact they evaluate our destroyers. The thing that, while we're on this naval period, is, you know, I was a little critical of John Harbert when he said picked on our weaknesses at this time of after the war. I gave you a copy of his letter, didn't I? My reply to his letter. I gave you that, didn't I? Yes.
Possibly, yeah, I'm not sure.
I pointed out to him that he made a very critical remark, and I said he hit the nail right on the head regarding the wide gap between the changing world and the Navy. And I said so, too. I couldn't disagree with him on that, but I wanted to remind him that although he was right, we either go down to the sea in ships and live ashore, there was a big gap between us. It would be fair to say that we ended the war with nothing to build from except a few of us who had already carried a big load under terrific pressure. We had hastily trained personnel who did nothing but their best under the circumstances and wanted to get established in civilian life. That's what they were trying to do. We were trying to, a few of us remaining were immediately under very heavy pressure because Canada decided to have a navy of some 10,000 and 20,000. What would we do under the circumstances? We were short of over 1,000 officers, for example. So we decided to transfer hundreds and hundreds of wartime officers with more experience at sea and little education. Otherwise, we could not have carried out the government policy. I think I've given you a paper on that already. And it was when we were trying to settle down to this, we tried the impossible. Here again, we're faced with the question, should we do as the others did? I'll go to the door. Yeah, I get a little vague on these, don't you?
Well, I think we've got a good one today, sir. Next day, if I can, we'll pick up with your impressions of unification and Canadian defense policy and your connection with the forces as a retired admiral. if that's agreeable with you.
Yes.
And we'll pull the plug on her today. Thank you very much for having me.